Thus I'll destroy. So the second, the next verse is like now making a commitment to overcome the cause or that fuel of hatred, which is displeasure. And so it's saying, thus I'll destroy the sustenance of this my nemesis, the nemesis being anger. The external enemy seems like the enemy. The real enemy is our own hatred. Thus I'll destroy the sustenance of this my nemesis. Other than causing harm to me, this enemy has no function. Anger does no good for us. It might motivate us to act on the short term, but those actions will end up being bad actions because they're motivated by anger. If you're motivated by anger, you should not act at all. You should just stop. In the fifth chapter, it talks about staying still like a block of wood, just not moving. And you can avoid it. This is what is taught in the teachings on awareness. So thus I'll destroy the sustenance of this, my nemesis, other than causing harm to me. The enemy has no function. So then, if we want to overcome our displeasure, then we have to actually kind of cultivate its opposite, which is delight. Whatever happens, I will not upset my cheerfulness. Displeasure won't fulfill my wishes, but strip away my virtues. So you have this commitment. I'm going to try to always, as it says in the Lojong slogans, always meditate on a joyful, what does it say? A joyful state of mind? Joyful frame of mind? Joyful mind. Always meditate on a joyful mind. So always try to keep joy in your mind, no matter what happens. Things work out, excellent, you can be joyous. Things don't work out, excellent. I've got an opportunity to practice patience. How wonderful. The more we can keep joy in our mind, because actually pleasure and displeasure, as we'll come into fairly soon, pleasure and displeasure are really just habits of mind. How do we think about things? There's nothing other than that about them. So if we can habituate our mind to looking at things positively, then we'll not see them negatively. It's like because it's all habituation. There are things that one person likes that another person doesn't like and will get unhappy about. Some people are going to be delighted if you give them oatmeal for breakfast every day, and some people are going to be just, you know, they say, "Oh God, oatmeal again." There's no difference in the oatmeal. It's the difference in the way you think about it. So if you train in yourself in being delighted every day they give you oatmeal, then it's excellent. It's good. If you can even do that with the breakfast foods you don't like, it's even better. And that's where it gets a little bit harder. So at any rate, so the displeasure has no harm, has no benefit. The anger has no benefit. It's just going to cause harm for us. So whatever happens, I will not upset my cheerfulness. Displeasure won't fulfill my wishes, but strip away my virtues. Displeasure, there are five different types of feelings. Here you're getting a talk from a Kenpo who spent too much time studying Abhidharma. There is pleasure, physical pleasure, physical pain, there's neutral feelings, there's mental pleasure, and there's displeasure, mental displeasure. It's a feeling in the mind. And of these five feelings, displeasure is the only one that is always negative. It's always afflicted. It's always attached to aversion. You're feeling aversion for something. So that displeasure is always afflicted. Now, sometimes you can be displeased about bad things, and then it's kind of a defiled virtue, kind of defiled, but basically you've always got a bit of aversion with displeasure. So anytime you're feeling displeasure about something, your mind is disturbed. And because your mind is disturbed, you won't be able to fulfill your wishes, but instead anything you do is going to be corrupted by that aversion that you're also feeling. So displeasure is a very harmful feeling. And actually it's usually kind of useless. I mean, there's no need to feel displeasure, because what do we feel? We feel displeased about things that we want or things that we don't want. And when it's things that we want not happening and things we don't want happening. And those situations where we might feel displeasure are either situations that we can fix or they're situations that we can't fix. There's no kind of middle ground. Either it can be fixed or it can't. Maybe it can be fixed but botched, I don't know. But either fixed or not fixed. And as it says, the next verse, it gives really helpful advice. If something can be fixed, what need is there to be displeased? If something can't be fixed, what good is it to be displeased? Is it to get displeased? To be displeased. To be displeased, I translate. I went back and forth on the translation of this verse like 5 times. So if you can, if you're in a situation where something wrong, something bad is happening, and you can change it, there's no need to be unhappy about it. You just change it. You fix it. If your car is broken, there's no need to kick the tire. You fix it. If it can't be fixed, then you junk it. There's no need to get unhappy about it. There's nothing to do. Getting unhappy, it's not going to do it. You know, if someone does something bad and you can't change the situation, there's no point in being unhappy or being displeased about it because it's not going to change it. Now, this is being displeased and seeing whether it was a good thing or not are different. So displeasure, we just mean that feeling of that feeling of like, this is bad, I didn't want it, I don't like it. That aversion, being unhappy about it. You can look at a situation on a more intelligent level and say, ah, this is something that I can't fix. It's not a good situation. I can't fix it now, but you can use your intelligence to deal with the situation somehow. And then it's going to be easier to deal with. Or if you're So saying you shouldn't be displeased is not saying that you can't, that you lose all your critical faculties. You can still think. It just means that you're taking kind of that emotional bit out of it and looking at it on a more reasonable way where you can actually get something done. Often it's that emotional bit that makes it impossible to fix the situation anyways. When you are in a conflict with someone else, and both people, you know, when there's a conflict between two people, both people are always to some degree at fault. Maybe one person is 10% at fault and the other person is 90% at fault. Or maybe one person thinks they're at 10% at fault and the other person is 90% at fault. They might think that you're not at all, you might think you're not at all in fault. It's completely the other person's fault. But anytime there's a conflict, there are two people involved. Both people have some degree of responsibility. And when you're in that situation, you've got some degree of responsibility. And as long as you're reacting out of displeasure and hatred, and anger, then you're not going to be able to, that situation isn't going to be able to fix. So actually letting go of your displeasure might make it into a situation where you can actually do something to help it. And then when you're not displeased, and then you can get by it, you can say, okay, this is a situation, let's see what we can do to fix it. Then you might be able to do something. And if you're not, then you might just need to distance yourself or whatever, get out of that situation. But at any rate, it's that displeasure doesn't help us. And there's no need for it. It doesn't benefit. It doesn't benefit ourselves. So that's the basic thing. So now we have to look at, well, what causes us to be displeased? And this is where we get to the set of 12 that I mentioned last night. There are 12 different things that we don't like, that we get angry over. And that's talked about in verse 11. We don't want pain, humiliation, insults, or disrepute, either for us or for our friends. It's the opposite for our foes. Okay, so what is it that we get displeased and angry about? When we experience pain, right? Physical pain. The second thing is humiliation. When people say things that are impolite, inappropriate, and we feel humiliated by them, that's the second sort of category. The third is when people insult us. They say harsh or insulting words. Sometimes we translate the same word as harsh speech. But insult is like saying they're saying nasty things. That's the third. And the fourth is disrepute, when people say things that that give you a bad reputation, that people don't like. So that's the fourth. So these are four things. When they happen to us, we get unhappy about it. And when they happen to our friends, we get unhappy about it. So when people do bad things to our friends, or say bad things about our friends, or insult our friends, or spread bad rumors about our friends, then that's another situation where we get angry. Right? So those are 8. We got 4 for ourselves, 4 for our friends, And then we've got for our foes, for our enemies, it's the opposite. In other words, we are unhappy when our enemies get good things, when they feel pleasure. We are unhappy when people speak to them well and nicely, when they say praise them, say good things about them, when they are happy. Or we might say we are unhappy when our enemies aren't experiencing pain, when they aren't being humiliated, insulted, or their reputations destroyed. Those are the sorts of things that cause us displeasure. So those are four for ourselves, four for our friends, and then the opposite four for enemies. Does that make it clear? That's 12, and the commentary goes on this for two pages. I don't know that I need to go on to it for two pages. It's pretty simple at basis. There are some commentaries that break it down into 24, but we won't worry about that. Basically, one of the things that's important is that we have to look at, when we look at, we see other people as enemies. We have to remember that that person we're seeing as an enemy, it's just kind of a temporary thing right now. You can often see this in this lifetime. There are enemies who, enemies one day, and then you actually find out what's happening, what they're really like, and you become good friends. They're good friends who then become enemies, siblings who become enemies. So the enemy that we actually have to deal with is our anger. That's an important point to stress. What time are we at? 11:16. So that's the looking at the causes of anger. And then after we've looked at the causes of anger, we've looked at the causes of anger, its fuel, the commitment to never be free of a joyful mind, and the examination of what we need to be patient of, the things that we want or don't want. Now we actually have to talk about how to overcome those that type, and that's the actual practice of patience. So first this talks about overcoming the anger that we feel when the things that we don't want are happening. Okay, so either we get angry when the things that we don't want happen, or we get angry when the things that we do want don't happen. So first we look at when the things we don't want happen. And this is taught about, several different sections. But first of all, we have to recognize that anger and hatred themselves, or the things that we don't want are actually, the pain and suffering are not completely bad in themselves. Actually, when you think about it, a feeling of pain, a physical feeling of pain is in itself, it is actually neutral. It's painful, yes, but it's not unvirtuous, it's not virtuous, it's neutral. You can react to it any way you want, but that feeling is just a feeling. There's nothing good or bad about it inherently, other than that it's the nature of pain. In itself, it's not necessarily a bad thing, and if we look at it in the right way, then actually it can be beneficial for us. And one way we can recognize it is if we didn't experience any pain, we would never want to do anything to better ourselves. In particular, it's taught that it's the cause of the wish for freedom. As it says in the verse, in verse 12, the causes of happiness are rare, the causes of pain are frequent. Without pain, there is no wish for freedom, so mind, you must be steadfast. So we have to remember when you experience pain and suffering in this lifetime that were there no pain and suffering, we'd never have any wish for freedom from samsara. We'd never have any wish to do anything to better ourselves. Forget about freedom from samsara. We'd never do anything even worldly to benefit ourselves. But in particular, when we experience pain, that we then can think about what is the nature of the pain, what is the nature of our life, what is the nature of our difficulties, and that's what inspires us to Dharma practice. One of the difficulties we have in this affluent society is that our lives are so comfortable that it's we don't experience that much pain. I think it's easier, and there are lots of things that distract us, pleasures that distract us. I think it was probably easier to really develop a wish for liberation in a time when you lived as like a peasant, or when your options, if your option was to go off and herd yak on the hills of Tibet and have a short and difficult life herding yak in a cold climate, or to go off and practice meditation to try to achieve enlightenment, it sounds much more attractive to practice meditation. But when your options include, winning lotteries, buying all sorts of expensive devices, all the pleasures that our society offers us, it's harder to really see that. When the pains of this lifetime are not as in our faces, because on a daily life, our lifestyle is so pleasant, we don't really develop that wish for freedom. And so because we don't really see pain, it's actually difficult for us to think, oh, I need to actually liberate myself. We think, I need something to kind of make myself a little bit better, a little bit of a panacea, something to help, something to be better off now. And that, of course, there's nothing wrong with that, of course, but it's limited. And so if you really have that aspiration to do something larger, then that comes out of recognizing that this lifetime is painful. Because even if we have pleasures now in our lifetime, we might have the best physical situation, we might have good food, or all organic and healthy, but at some point it's not going to be enough. At some point it's just, it's just the nature of life that at some point we're going to get sick and die. When we get to be the age of sometime, if we last this long, the chances of us actually being really kind of functional past the age of 80 are difficult. Some people do. It's hard. It's kind of a lottery. Some people are actually quite active and with it all the way into their 90s, and some quite in the late 90s. But for most people, when you start getting to a certain age, you start losing it. And if we spend this first part of our lifetime so distracted by the pleasurable aspects of this lifetime, that we don't do anything to really change it, don't do anything to get out of this situation, to fix it, to make it better, then when we get to that time, it's going to be too late. So we have to really, when we have the opportunity, we have to use it. There's just no choice. I mean, otherwise, what is it? Otherwise, we have no idea what's going to happen in the future, and how we're going to be when we get to, whether we're going to get to an old age, and if we get to an old age, are we going to have our wits about us, or are we going to be demented? It could go either way for any of us. So we can't take it for granted. While we have this opportunity, we have to recognize that we have it. We have to make use of it. And the only reason thing that allows us to do that is if we look at our situation honestly and see that either we're experiencing pain now, or we're experiencing things that are going to turn into pain, that are the causes of future pain. And so when you think about that, that pain is necessary. So when that pain occurs, we can take it as a teacher. We don't have to look at it as an enemy. We don't have to look at it as something we're going to push away. And in that way, it helps us develop that wish for freedom. So it's really important, the fact that we're suffering. It's like is often said in the teachings, the long-lived gods have no opportunity to practice the Dharma. The reason why they have no opportunity to practice Dharma is because everything is perfect until 7 days before they die. Then they start to have body odor. And the other gods shun them, and they know where they're going, and they experience intense psychological suffering, realizing that they've wasted the last several million years of their lifetime. So our lifetimes are not a million years long, but if we get to that point, we realize, I could have done something, but I didn't. Then it's, we have to... we can be kind of thankful for the difficulties we experience in our lives. Without them, none of you would be here today. So the next thing is thinking about what actually do we need to be develop patience for? What is the reason for being patient? We aren't being patient. I mean, there are lots of reasons why you can put up with pain. You can put up with pain so that you can run a marathon. You can put up with pain so you can do the Ironman triathlon. You can put up with pain for lots of different reasons. You can put up with pain so that you can become a better soldier. You can put up with pain so that you can do something else worldly. It might be either virtuous, it might be unvirtuous, it might be neutral, but all of these things are not necessarily going to really bring any benefit. I mean, you've run a marathon, yeah, it's a nice, sure, I'm sure it's a fine thing to do, and that there people get something out of doing it. That's fine if you want to run a marathon, but it's going to bring you benefit for a short period of time at best. So, and when we look at it, people are actually willing to go through extreme things for even for mistaken ideas. That's what this next verse is talking about. The Durga cults and Carnotans pointlessly bear the sensations of burns and wounds, so why am I a coward for freedom's sake? So this is talking about some ancient Indian cults. Of course, Shantideva in the 8th century, everyone knew what the Durga cults were. And they knew about the Carnotan, so he didn't need to explain it, but we don't know what they are. So Durga is a Hindu goddess. She's actually kind of a form of Uma, who was the goddess Uma, who was like, which of the gods? I always forget. Yes, God Indra. So the god Indra, the gods were in the battle with the demigods. They lost. They were wondering. They saw Indra sitting in meditation on a hillside and thought, if he were on our side, we could win. So they then conjured up this goddess Uma to seduce him. And she woke him up out of his meditation. They got married, more or less. I don't know if there's actually like a marriage ceremony, but they became, husband and wife. And then the gods triumphed over the demigods. But Uma also has a wrathful form, Durga. And so the Durga cults, they would burn themselves, they'd go through all sorts of austerities in order to please the goddess Durga. Because if Durga were pleased, then they would be able to go to the higher realms. So they'd put up with these out of this mistaken idea of what going to the higher realms is. They'd willingly torture themselves by burning. The Carnotans are from South India, apparently, and they were a cult where when there were eclipses, they would fight in battle, and those who were decapitated in the battle would be immortalized by having their names written down. And so this is such a great thing to be immortalized by by having your name written down after being decapitated, that they would willingly go into this battle and or fight each other and get wounded or decapitated for this. So they're willing to put up with this for their own ideas of freedom. We don't even have to look at it. You can look at that. You can look at the suffering that people go through in medical school, being a resident, the exhaustion of medical school, the efforts that we go through for lots of different things. We go through a lot of effort for relatively minor ends. And if we've got that great goal, again, we have to remember our basis is bodhicitta, right? We're thinking, what do we want to do? We want to become Buddhas for the sake of all sentient beings. So if that is our goal, they're willing to do this just for like being reborn in the higher realms in the next life, forget about future lifetimes. We've got an even bigger goal. Why don't we have as much courage as them? Basically, why am I a coward for freedom's, why am I a coward for freedom's sake? The point is that everything is, as I said before, everything is due to your habituation. There's nothing at all that is not easy if you are used to it. By getting used to minor pains, you'll bear great harms as well. So things that are painful for us when we're not used to them are easy for people who are used to them. It's all how you're looking at it. It's really a question, it comes down to mind. There are things that are painful for us that are pleasurable for others. Some people like to get whipped and most people don't. But it's all a question of what you like and what you think. It's in your mind. It's not anything else. It's not the whip. It's not the pain out there. It's how you're thinking about it. That's what's important. So when you think about it in the right way, it's not so bad. Like last night, I mentioned this person I'd been speaking about who had been afraid, you know, when she was in her 20s, she was slept in her car in all sorts of weather all the time. Now she's in her 50s and she wanted something comfortable, but had to sleep in her car, and it wasn't that bad, really. That's kind of a minor thing. Sleeping in cars is probably pretty comfortable too, compared to what a lot of people get to sleep in. So it's what we're used to, what we're thinking about. Going in, when you travel to India, it's actually not that bad. Yes, the mattresses are thin and a little bit lumpy, but it's not that bad. If you're in the Indian guest house, if you want to pay a lot of money, you can stay in comfort in India, more comfort than here. But anyway, there's nothing at all that is not easy if you're not used to it. But the point of this is that then we can actually get used to greater and greater difficulties, greater and greater pains. We can extend our abilities. The stories of the Buddha tell, the previous lives of the Buddha tell all sorts of stories about the Buddha sacrificing body parts, cutting off, you know, pieces of flesh and feeding them to people who needed human flesh for medicine, or things like that. Cutting off hands and legs and so forth. Giving away his, this is very futile, I'm sorry. It's a very futile thing I'm about to say. Giving away his wife and children to anyone who asked for them, giving away all his possessions, things that most of us would be just unable to do. But because of the Buddha's great compassion, he was able to do it without any regret. That's because of habituating himself. So you start out with small things, and then you go to eat. I mean, you don't start out by saying, oh, yes, you'd like you need some human flesh. Here, let's take a knife. I'll slice you off a piece of my thigh for you. You don't start out by doing that. You start out with small things, and then as you gradually get used to think about smaller and small, as you start out with small things and you gradually get used to larger and larger difficulties, then you'll be able to bear more. Now, we're not talking about, you know, giving pieces of human flesh, especially since it's not part of modern medicine anyways. No one prescribes human flesh for, yeah, you've got Ebola virus, here, have a chunk of thigh. No one's going to say that. It's just not our medicine anymore. But we do encounter difficulties as you do this. And particularly, you'll find there are a lot of psychological, there are difficulty of being on the path. It's not so easy to follow the path. If you ever do a long retreat, it's not so easy. If you do a group retreat, especially in the West, there's a lot of difficulty of dealing with the other retreatments. It's one of the biggest problems of doing a group retreat. Or difficulties, I shouldn't say. It's one of the biggest difficulties of doing a group retreat. And so if you can start by developing patience now in your regular lifetime, then when you get to the point when you, for instance, if you ever decide in the future, yes, I really want to do a three-year retreat, then you'll be able to put up with the difficulties of being in that three-year retreat better. If we aren't able to put up with difficulties, it's really difficult. It's really hard to practice the Dharma. You know, we had Drupin Kempo Thabu, who some of you met last year, talked about this quite a bit. You know, we have to, if you can't put up with pain, if you can't put up with things, there's no way you can practice. When you're sitting in meditation for 2 hours, you have to get used to 2-hour sessions. At the beginning, you will have to, your body's going to have to adjust. You have to sit, get through that period of adjustment. Your knees or your back or something else is going to ache. And there are certain things you can do to fix it, but you might, if you try to fix it all the time and don't just get used to it, you know, you're going to have difficulty. It's going to be hard. It's because the more you do to fix, you might as well just get used to the situation, is his point. So you have to be able to really have some fortitude to be able to practice intensively, and that's what eventually we have to get to. Of course, it takes a while to get there. You have to, again, do it as you feel is appropriate for yourself. So, let's see, where are we? I'm just going to go a few more verses this morning. Why don't I see the pointless pains of serpents and mosquitoes, of feelings of hunger and thirst and such, and rashes and so forth? So we just naturally, in our lifetimes, there are pains that we have to put up with. There are black flies in May. You know, what are you going to do? They're going to bite you. What are you going to do? This is hard to get around it. We're going to get hungry and thirsty. Now, in this particular society, we don't need to worry as much about hunger and thirst and such. In the time of Shantideva, they would have famines and people would have nothing to eat. It was common. There would be droughts when people wouldn't have enough to drink. Even when you're in a long meditation session, you're in there for two hours meditating, you may well get thirsty, and you kind of have to just sit through it. You know, it's just, that's what happens. The feelings of hunger, thirst, and such, and rashes and so forth. We get all sorts of rashes and illnesses and difficulties, and we have to put up with those. And we don't have much choice. I mean, you get medicine, of course. You do have the choice of taking care of it. But as long as it's there, you don't have much choice but to bear with it until it heals. We are willing to put up with them. So thus I won't be thin-skinned about heat, cold, and wind, and rain, or illness, bondage, beatings, and such. Being so makes them worse. So it's when you are tender, when you let yourself be thin-skinned, that's when you are going to experience pain. You know, if you can be a little bit tougher, if you can develop toughness, then you'll be able to deal with everything much more easily. And basically, whether you're tough or not is all a question of your mind and what you're used to. You gradually get used to things. Now, I'm not saying that therefore you all have to go out and start meditating in caves on Mount Katahdin. Are there any caves on Mount Katahdin? Yes. Okay. So you can go up to Mount Katahdin. I mean, it'd probably be a great retreat place to go up there and spend 12 years like Milarepa on a cave on Mount Katahdin. Then it would become a holy mountain, which would be even better. But if you're not ready to do it, you can't. You have to develop your abilities and go gradually to the point where you're then able to be, because when you know how to deal with it, when you're able to put up with it, then you're able to do it. I think even the people who lived in Maine 100 years ago had to put up with a lot more than we do now. I don't think that the indoor heating worked quite as well back then. You had to actually haul your coal upstairs or haul your firewood upstairs. It wasn't nearly as easy. We just turn up the thermostat. We don't have to do any work, right? So people back 100 years ago, they put up with it, and they even thought, hey, we have indoor heating because we've got coal. They thought that was great. Imagine what it was like even 200 years ago when you had to chop down the trees yourself. So it's all about our attitude. And the example that Shantideva gives is an example of battle. He gives a lot of battle imagery in this, partially because of the time he was in. Some seeing their own blood become exceptionally courageous, and some on seeing another's blood will faint and fall unconscious. This is from steadfastness of mind or else from cowardice. Thus disregard the injuries, do not let pains affect you. So, you know, the people would go into battle, and some people, you know, the heroes, they would go and they'd put up with anything. They get a little nick here or there. Yeah, it's kind of like, what is it? And Peter was talking about his favorite English thing is Monty Python. It's kind of like the Black Knight at the... But, you know, no matter what happens to you, you get a little nick here or there, then you feel then the warrior feels even more courage and goes into battle. And some, the first time you go into battle, someone who's green and they see someone get shot and they just like can't deal with it. They just fall over. And so what is this from? It's about your mind, about how you deal with it in your mind. It's not about the physical things. So it's from steadfastness of mind or else from cowardice. Now, of course, the people going into battle are going in for no good reason, solely to commit misdeeds. But for us, we've got the greater goal of achieving Buddhahood. So it's really important to keep that in mind, because that's what makes the real hero. What is it? Where am I getting in here? I'm having trouble looking at my different texts. So though pain occurs, the wise do not disturb their joy of mind. So because pain and disturbances comes from our own attitude and not from the external, as long as we keep that joyful frame of mind, no matter what's happening around us, then we'll be okay. As it says here, when waging war against afflictions, harms plentiful in battle. They are the triumphant heroes who ignore all pain and quash hatred and such the enemy. Everyone else kills corpses. So when we go into Buddhist, into Dharma practice, it's going to be difficult. It's going to be hard. This is just the nature of practice. There will be times when it's just excruciating. If you've ever done any retreat, perhaps you might get to this in a weekend, but there'll be times when you just feel like you cannot sit any longer. If you do like a week or a month retreat or a long retreat, especially at the beginning, I think we get that phase. We just feel like you can't sit. But if you keep going through it, that's what's really showing courage. When the warriors go into battle and they're just killing other people, are going to die anyways. If you go into enemy, like we killed Donald Trump had al-Baghdadi killed a week ago now? And then a few years ago, Obama had Osama bin Laden killed. It's actually kind of pointless because they're going to die anyways. I mean, why bother? It's just like killing a corpse. There's no point. If you're going into battle, you're killing people, what good does it do? You're not doing anything that's not going to happen to them anyways. Death is coming to us all, so there's no point in doing that. But what is really extraordinary, what is really showing heroism, is when you can overcome the hatred in your mind, the hatred that then leads to anger and violence and so forth. That is our true enemy, and if we can overcome that hatred, that is really the sign of a true hero, a true warrior. Warrior, to use the Shambhala speak. So I think that is enough for this morning, at least for me this morning. Maybe you all have some questions or thoughts or whatever. Yes.
I have a question about the first couple verses. It makes sense to me that they're making a case for how important cultivating patience is and how serious anger is. But I'm also just wondering sort of about the harshness of it. I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit about how
this might interact with the idea of like having self-compassion when your anger arises. Okay. Shantideva doesn't mince words when he's talking about these things. It's true. He's quite blunt about it and talks about the sort of the extreme. Now, the one moment's anger shatters all good deeds accumulated in 1,000 eons. It is pretty strong. Well, first of all, you have to recognize that it's, you have to, when you're dealing with anger, you have to appreciate that anger is really bad and that it's harmful. So you have to recognize that, because if you don't recognize that it's harmful, you're not going to do what you can to overcome it completely. And when Shantideva is talking about overcoming anger, he's not talking about just learning how to deal with it in our lives. He's talking about it eliminating it from our mind streams entirely. So it's a much bigger goal. So you've got to have that understanding of how harmful it is. Otherwise, we might get a little bit too... we might not have enough oomph to really do it. And we might get attached to some anger and not others, as I was speaking about last night. So... that's kind of pointing it out on that level. Now, the issue in our current culture, we aren't usually so blunt. We generally kind of downplay these things and say, oh, maybe, you know, it'd be nice and be kind and gentle and all that. And there are times when that is necessary, and that's fine. But sometimes we also have to kind of go a little bit further than that. We have to say, this is bad, this is harmful, this is something that I don't want to do. I really don't want to get angry again. When you think about that time you got angry and how horrible it was and the bad effect that it's going to have, and you really think about that, that gives you the impetus that I need to do something about it. So this is kind of in general, talking about it in general, for how do you think about it at ahead of time in general. When you've got that specific moment of getting angry, you recognize that the reason you're getting angry is because you don't have control over your mind. And so that's not something that you beat yourself up about. It's something that you work to gain that control over your mind. And so then Shantideva presents the methods for doing that. If you compound your anger at others with anger at yourself, it doesn't help. But that being said, there's a certain, sometimes in our culture we get a little bit too gentle on ourselves, actually. It's sometimes good to be a little bit firm, to give ourselves to realize it is bad, it is harmful. Because if we don't do that, we might end up actually inadvertently doing something, getting angry at a time when we shouldn't have, and really getting angry at all and just doing something horrible. Yes, Peter.
Just to follow up on that great question, could you say a bit more about confession and how that lessens? I mean, that seems to be the...
Yes. Well, it's when you do lose your stack and you or when you do get angry, then you should confess it. Basically, the Gyawan Karmapa was talking a few years ago. He talked in a teaching about how there was some psychological research that shows that if you regret something soon after you do it, it doesn't have as much of an impact on you. So these antidotes of patience are designed for helping you before you lose anger, preventing you from losing your temper. If you do lose your temper, then you do confession, and so that means, first of all, regretting that instant of anger. Second of all, it means then taking like a support. The Buddhism Bodhisattvas as your support, and then using an antidote, which means doing something virtuous. To kind of counteract it, because you've done something negative with the anger, so you do something positive to counteract it. And then having the resolve, I am never going to do this again. And so that virtuous act, there are many different ones that we can do. You can do any virtuous act. You can do a gift. You can, being generous. You can recite a sutra. In particular, there's a sutra called the Sutra in Three Sections that we often recite as a confession. You can recite the Vajrasattva mantra. You can do all sorts of things. And so like those sutras and the mantras, if you don't know them, then the center here can help you get those resources. And then the fourth one is really important, the resolve never to do it again. Because if you think, I'm never going to do it again, except when... you won't purify it. So you do that as soon as you can after you get angry and recognize how it is. And that counteracts it. There's nothing good about misdeeds except that they can be confessed. Yes?
I just wanted to ask a follow-up on my question last night about fairness.
Mm.
And I was thinking about the unfairness when, for instance, in the Me Too movement, men and women get treated quite differently.
Mm-hmm.
Two people doing the same job get treated quite differently,
mm-hmm.
compensated quite differently. Or siblings, two siblings can be treated quite differently, especially male and female, older and younger. Oftentimes a younger sibling gets treated quite differently. So I was thinking about that type of fairness, and it brings up anger. And I was wondering if you had something to say or some advice on how to work with that type of anger that comes up in those types of unfair situations.
Yeah, well, this comes up a little bit later on in the text when we talk about seeing things, because you're not talking about an offense that happens specifically to yourself in this sense, you're talking about looking at others.
Both can be both.
Both, yeah. Okay, both. Okay, the question is, in terms of fairness, we have instances where, in particular, there's the issues I shouldn't say men and women, because it's also boys and girls, males and female children being treated differently, people being compensated differently for a similar work, and so forth, and issues of fairness that can lead to anger, and basically to... So there's It's an interesting question. When we look at it from the Buddhist perspective, and I'm going to be a little bit, what do we say? I'm going to be a little bit, maybe not so politically sensitive right now. When you look at it from a Buddhist perspective, those sufferings that the individuals experience, now whatever the societal conditions are, is a different matter. The fact that that individual is in that position and experiencing that unfairness at that moment is a result of that individual's previous actions and karma, often in the past. That doesn't mean that that individual is guilty, because that individual probably does not remember those actions. Probably. And they end up in the situation out of their karma, not by any fault of their own, because when they act unskillfully in previous lifetimes, they're doing it out of forces that are beyond their control, as we'll be describing, talking about later on in this. And so there are a lot of things that put people in those positions. Some people, because of their previous actions, are born in positions where they're treated more favorably. Some people, because of their previous actions, are born in positions where they're treated less favorably. And so when you have that understanding, then seeing the person being treated unfavorably because of the in that situation becomes a place where you feel a lot of compassion for them because of their previous, that they're experiencing a pain and suffering as a result of their previous karma. So if we want to avoid those situations in the future, we need to avoid doing negative actions that create the karma for being treated unfairly in the future. That means we need to be generous. We need to practice discipline. We need to be patient. We need to practice all of the virtues so that in the future, we won't experience those. So that we have that compassion and that understanding that we need to avoid those situations in the future. So that's kind of thinking about the nature of how that specific individual got into that specific position. It's because of the karma. It's because it's purely our karma. It's not purely our karma that we're born male or female. There's also our own cravings and attachments that lead to the gender that we're born in, according to the Buddhist way of explaining it. And so it's this combination of circumstances that are beyond our control at the moment that put us in that position to experience it. So when it's that level, there's a different idea of fair or unfair. And in fact, if I were asked to translate a question about fairness or justice back into Tibetan, I would have a difficult time of trying to figure out, how do you say fair in Tibetan? I mean, my Tibetan is not perfect. There are a lot of worldly things that I don't talk about, and I kind of avoid talking about politics, so I just don't know the words because of that. But when I look at the Buddhist texts, I don't see any word that I would translate as fairness or justice. So then we come to the situation where we see a situation that in the worldly terms now is fair or unfair. Well, first of all, getting angry doesn't change it. It doesn't do anything to help it. It doesn't change it in the slightest. And in fact, may make it more difficult to change. This is another sort of situation where I was talking about last night, where when you're acting out of anger, you actually might end up doing something that causes more difficulties, more problems. Maybe not immediately, but sometime in the future. We want to make sure that when we're going to act in a situation, that we're going to act out of wisdom, out of compassion, and out of loving kindness for the person who is suffering, and also for the person who is causing that suffering, because they're both sentient beings. One might be experiencing the result of karma, the other might be accumulating karma. Both are worthy of compassion and loving kindness. And so when we start looking out on that broader level, then we might be able to find some way where we can approach the problem constructively and do things to benefit it, benefit the situation. Now, doing something to benefit the situation may involve doing things that might seem confrontational. doing protests, whatever. I mean, you all know better than I what's going on, because I'm off in Asia and a hole in a monastery, basically. Except for the internet. But, you know, whatever we're doing, when we're doing those actions that are necessary on a day-to-day level to deal with them, if we are doing them with hatred in our heart, if we are doing them with anger, then we might do something that is beneficial in the long time and in the short term, but because we ourselves have been acting out of anger, we are just accumulating causes so that we ourselves in the future will be born in perhaps a situation very similar to that again. So we have to do what we can to approach these situations out of loving kindness, compassion, and wisdom. And what we do, the specific actions is not something I'm qualified to speak about. But when we think about things in terms of fair or unfair, there are different reasons why different beings are taught, are treated. There's a lot of karma coming in, there's a lot of other circumstances, there's the way that person behaves in this lifetime, and there's a different balance that comes in. For a child who's being discriminated against because of his or her gender or race or so forth, it's probably mainly karmic. When it comes to be someone who's at a later stage in life, there are many other conditions that also may play into it. It's a very difficult situation to see what's really going on, what are all the causes and conditions, because karma is so incredibly complex. So basically, if you're experiencing anger at it, I think you need to step back and look at it. Think about what we'll be going over these issues later. Thinking about why the people who are discriminating are discriminating. What is the actual effect of this and so forth. And when you think about that a little bit more and stepping back and looking at it, I think that can help decrease the anger. But in particular, we're dividing people into the oppressed and the oppressors. It's easy to feel compassion for the oppressed, difficult to feel it for the oppressors. And so we need to feel compassion for both equally. Yes?
How does that fit in with the idea of the suffering of suffering?
The suffering of suffering. Well, the suffering of suffering is any experience that is painful physically or mentally. So if it's painful or stressful physically or mentally, then it's a suffering of suffering.
So the suffering of seeing people suffer.
Well, that's mental. That's displeasure. Okay. I mean, it could also be compassion. When you see someone suffering and you can't bear it, then that would be compassion. When you feel someone suffering and you get unhappy about it, then that would be displeasure. So when it's that displeasure, then it's the suffering of suffering. When it's compassion, I don't think it would be classified as suffering of suffering. So it's a very different way of looking at it than we see in our culture. And, you know, the question of fair or unfair is a really interesting one, and we often just use it as it becomes something that kind of increases our confrontationalism and our difficulties, our dualistic way of seeing things. So that's, yeah. Yes, Meg?
I guess just to, I'm just thinking from my situation, so being born a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And experiencing, say, less pay, less perhaps respect in profession, etc.
Yeah.
So that's a result of my own karma coming together.
It's a result of many conditions, of which karma is one.
Okay. So with that, the way for me to work with that is to better myself.
Mm-hmm.
Develop bodhicitta for myself and all sentient beings, and work on wanting to be a Buddha, so that in my next life, perhaps, I can be in a in a situation where, I don't know, I was just thinking, oh, so my next life, then I can maybe experience being a male.
No, you're doing it so you can experience being a Buddha. Yeah. Yeah. So you've got to really distinguish the worldly things from the Dharma or from the transcendent. There's a big distinction between the worldly and the transcendent. If it is worldly and you are born as a woman and you experience certain types of suffering because of being a woman, that is samsara. If you are born as a man and you experience certain types of suffering because of being a man, that is samsara. If you get equal pay as a woman, you are still in samsara. If you get equal respect, you are still in samsara. If you are attached to the idea of being respected, then you are still creating causes of future suffering. If you are attached to the idea of getting paid, you are still accumulating causes of future suffering. It is all samsara. No matter what good comes out of it on a societal level, none of it transcends samsara. None of it is going to lead you to actual happiness. You will get equal pay, and then something else will not be right, because it is samsara. This is the Buddhist way of looking at it. Which doesn't mean that it's bad to try to make it happen, because anything we can do to help people, you know, be happy in this lifetime is worth it, but we've got to keep a perspective on what actually is important. Maybe that's enough for this morning and lunchtime. One thing I'd like to say now, we did the Mahayana Sojung vows this morning, and tomorrow we were planning on doing them at 6 a.m., but I realized that tomorrow morning, because of daylight saving times shifting, solar noon is going to happen just a little bit before noon, so there wouldn't be time for people to have lunch before solar noon if they took the Mahayana Sojung vows. So tomorrow we will not have Mahayana Sojung vows at 6 a.m. Okay.